Well, hello. Welcome to the Creative Writing Life podcast. I am your host, Paul Zeidman. Still no theme song, working on it. I don't know if we'll ever get around to it. But in the meantime, I'm very excited to be talking to my guests today, the writing team of Tobias Bakel and David Kletcher. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
No, my pleasure. And they're going to be talking about their new book, The Runes of Engagement, which is published through Tachyon Publications, one of the coolest sounding publishing names I've ever heard. But we'll get to that in just a minute. For readers, I always say this, readers, or for listeners and viewers of the show, we always like to start things off by talking about things we may have read or watched lately. And I will go first to give you two gentlemen a time to collect your thoughts. So mostly been watching, been really enjoying Shogun on FX. I think they're doing a fantastic job with that. That I'm really enjoying. And also Apple TV, they put out a two-part documentary about Steve Martin called Steve! Exclamation point. I've watched the first half, which is kind of about how he got into stand-up, and it ends with him just about to really go into his movie career. So I'm looking forward to catching the second half of that. Very fascinating stuff, really. I mean, I'd read his book, Standing Up, a couple of years ago when that came out. That was really good. And I think this is just more of a great addition to really exploring more about Steve Martin, about how he approaches comedy, and also about his emotional take on all of the things that were happening to him over the years and during that time. It's just fascinating to listen to, and really looking forward to seeing how they tackle his movie career. So looking forward to watching that probably this weekend. But in the meantime, Tobias, David, whoever wants to go first, please go ahead. Don't be shy.
Go for it, man.
I'm also really enjoying Shogun. In particular, I love the fun that they're having with translation. The way in which the characters, when they're translating across different, not just different culture, but just language choices, where the interpreter is often changing things back and forth. And there are just some interesting places there that I just have to tip my hat to the writers for being aware of that place and really being subtle in some ways, because there's a lot that you're looking at how they're choosing to translate stuff between the characters that I really, that's been one of my favorite parts of Shogun. There are a lot of parts that are really interesting, but that for me has been like the most fun. I've been rewinding it and looking at like, okay, what did they just say? And what did the subtitles say? You know,
That's a great
touch. So there's
a
lot of nuance and stuff that's happening there in the episodes in translation that I'm just really enjoying. And then the show that I want to say that I was recommended it by Charlie Jane Anders, but Extraordinary, which I don't know where it's streaming. It took me a while to find it, actually. But it's a popular streamer has it. It's I think a English TV show, but it's about really weird superpowers.
So maybe it's on the BBC or
no, it
Brit
was,
Box,
it
maybe?
Was on, I want to say it was on Hulu, but like
okay.
Hulu and Disney have merged, and I don't have a Hulu app anymore. Anyway, it took me 30 minutes to find it, but I saw like three recommendations for it on my social media, and I'm pretty sure it was from Charlie Jane Anders. And so I thought, I mean, I've never been steered wrong, so let's go take a look, and thoroughly enjoyed it. So my wife and I consumed it over the last like week, basically.
Real quick, what's it about?
It is about a world in which everyone gets a superpower at 18, but a lot of them are very mundane. There's a character who, like in the very beginning, you see can just like, they can basically, the people who can fly are basically running Uber cabs. You know, they've got like a big thing you can strap yourself onto and they'll take you where you need to be. It just looks at like the sort of like, if superpowers really were prevalent and everyone had them, what would the mundanity of this all look like? Does a really good job of that, but there's a character who has not been able to get her superpower when she turned 18, and now she's in her 20s. And it's kind of about like, you know, trying to figure out who you are and trauma and relationships and all of that stuff. It's remarkably funny and irreverent and a lot of fun and creative in all kinds of interesting ways. And the superpowers are really fascinating. For example, her stepdad can sense strong emotions in people. So like he, there's this whole scene where he's in a crowd and he suddenly realizes that someone's going through a really tough time and he's getting hyper obsessed about trying to figure out who it is. So just stuff like that is just it completely nukes an idea I had for a book where everyone gets like useless superpowers. But I have like a couple bits from, and it's like this show did exactly what I was thinking of would be funny, and it did it so much better than any of the sort of nascent ideas I had lying around. So it was kind of great because I actually shut down that whole project. I was like, this is great, I don't have to write this.
Does it have a lot of that dry British wit to it?
Yes, very much. And a lot of that irreverent blue collar British humor as well. It's really clever.
All right, fantastic. David,
Thanks.
what about you?
So, staying on that theme, what I've been reading, what I'm reading right now, I'm in the middle of, is The Bullet That Missed by Richard Osman. Osman is a British TV producer and presenter. He's done various TV shows, and he just up and started writing a murder mystery series featuring four septuagenarians in their retirement village, solving murders in their charming little seaside British town. And it's absolutely delightful. What I've been watching, what I'm always watching, I'm never caught up, is again on the British side of things, Taskmaster.
Oh, okay.
So I just adore the show. It's if you're not familiar, it's a comedian and musician named Alex Horn makes up tasks for five comedians over 10 episodes, and they work these sometimes over the course of months will work these tasks, and they're absolutely absurd. Like, here's a boulder, get it as far away from here as you can in an hour, right? And they'll present some of these as films in a live studio audience sort of way, and then they'll do one final task for the show, and they'll get points, and there'll be it's one of the most bizarre, bonkers shows I've ever seen, and they're on 17 series of it now. And it's been exported to all over the EU and Australia and New Zealand and stuff like that. And if there was a US attempt, it was absolutely awful. But
No,
yeah.
I know Taskmaster very well. My wife
Okay.
introduced me to it, and so every time like a new season comes up, she's like, "There's a new episode of Taskmaster." That's like our
Yeah.
Friday night, designated
Yep.
time. Like we'll have dinner, then hit the couch. Okay, let's watch this episode. And she also listens to the podcast. She loves the show, and I do enjoy it a lot. It's a lot more amusing and entertaining than you would imagine.
Yeah, it's really off the wall. And it started as a stage show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival years and years and years ago. And it's just really crazy and a lot of fun.
Okay, fantastic. Okay. Well, gentlemen, we are here. This is the Creative Writing Life podcast, so we're going to talk about the writing aspect. So this really is directed to both of you. Now, were both of you writers like since you were kids, or did you kind of come into it a little later in life? So now, according to the bio, it says Tobias, you're the award-winning writer, and that David, you came in, sounds like you might have come into it later, but whoever wants to go first, kind of like talking about your background as a writer.
Dave, why don't you start?
Okay.
It's weird because there are two of us, so I'm like, I've got to like point or something.
David just
So I did
pointed for the
not.
listeners.
Yeah, I did not come into it later. I've been writing for quite a while. And here I'm gonna lay out a really funny comparison I brought up to Toby 1,000 years ago. And to delve into Toby's bio a little bit, my man here grew up in the Caribbean, almost literally in the Caribbean, right? Kind of a few years on this island over here, and then over here, and then just kind of bouncing around until just before college, he ended up in Ohio and stayed. And when he got to college, he was like, great. I have got all this time to write. I've got all this amazing time to write. I'm just going to write. Your boy Dave here grew up in suburban Detroit and barely left suburban Detroit in 18 years of growing up in suburban Detroit. And he got to college, and I had started writing in high school, and writing as a means of escape, and writing as a way to cope with 2-hour round trips to high school for reasons. And I got to college, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. I can do stuff now. And I stopped writing and went and did stuff and went and did stuff for years and just did stuff because I had, again, unlike my good friend Toby here, I did not have a wealth of life experience at that point. I had 18 years in Metro Detroit, which again can be very exciting, but wasn't. So I started writing very early, and then kind of took a big break. I wrote here and there, kept things up. Life happened a lot, did the day job thing, still doing the day job thing. Have just been kind of moseying along at my own pace for quite a while.
Okay.
Dave kept it all so stealth that like the way we, so I'll just talk about how we became collaborators, right?
Sure. Please. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Dave is one of the people I've known in the US for the longest. I came to the US my senior year of high school and came to college in a little place called Bluffton, Ohio, which is where I kind of am the opposite of Dave in that like I had a very exciting bounce around the world life and then came to college here in the US and just stayed put. And I'm still living in the same town I landed in the States basically in. But I started going to conventions when I first started getting published because people told me that's what you're supposed to do. So I'd go to these science fiction conventions. And the very first science fiction convention I ever attended was just up the road, 1 hour in Metro Detroit. And so the reason I've known Dave ever since 2001 was I went to this little convention called Confusion in Metro Detroit, just outside of Metro Detroit in 2001. And I knew nobody. I had just published a couple of short stories. I knew no one under the sun, and I went to this convention. I didn't even know what conventions were about or what the whole shtick was, really. But a friend of mine that I knew online, a fellow writer, Charlie Finley, who lived in Columbus, said that if I went to the convention, he would meet up and have lunch with me. And I did not know a lot of other writers at that time. And so I just, you're young, you're hungry, you want to meet other writers. So I thought, okay, great. At least I'll meet one person at this event. So I went to this place. I met Charlie, and Charlie was only going to be there for lunch. He just drove up to see me, which was a bummer. So after, he said he was going to be leaving after lunch, I was like, I don't know anyone here. I'm like, feeling really out of my depth. And he says, let me introduce you to a friend I know called Dave. So Dave was the first friend I ever made at a convention. And for years, we got on like a house on fire. I stay up late. So he and I would always end up in a corner somewhere at 2 a.m. talking about whatever, geopolitics, science fiction we'd read. And Dave never really trotted out the fact that he wrote a lot in his spare time. He just kept that on the down low. So we were just friends that talked about everything but writing, basically, unless Dave had like a writing question, in which case we talk about that. But for years and years and years, I did not know that Dave had an active writing process on the side until he mentioned to me he wanted to get into CIFLA, and he was a bit short on the number of short stories that he needed to get in, and was looking at that as it's one of the goals. You really want to break into CIFLA. And he wanted to get in, not just to get into CIFLA. Like I had it as a selfish goal. Dave wants to get into CIFLA because someone wanted help and he wanted to volunteer because he's a good guy, and he's like, I want to get into CIFLA so I can help. And I was like, okay, so let's collaborate on some short stories and we'll get you into CIFLA and then you can do your volunteering. So we started to write some short stories together and having a lot of fun doing that. Just a lot of fun.
Okay, I have to ask. So I'm not as familiar with the publishing world. So what is CIFLA?
Oh, great question. Dave, what's SIFWA?
Yeah. So SIFWA, S-F-W-A, is the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. It's an old organization founded in the 50s by some of the old lights of science fiction, the science fiction writing world. And it was just it's like the Romance Writers Association or horror writers. It's a kind of an industry trade group to, you know, bring everybody together, share ideas, share thoughts, share warnings about, you know, predatory behavior in the publishing world, kind of band together to address issues with publishers and a nice trade organization. And it is kind of like within the science fiction and fantasy writing world, it is kind of a benchmark for, you know, you've kind of made it when you qualify for membership.
Okay. I also have one small follow-up question to your story. So you said you went to a convention. So when you say a convention to me, I automatically think like Comic-Con or WonderCon, you know, like, you know, movies, comics, you know, all kinds of, you know, nerd and geek stuff. So was this that kind of thing, or was this more like just more for writers?
It is kind of. So this is also the confusion is in a tradition of science fiction conventions specifically that also started around this time in the 50s of small fan-run gatherings in a hotel for a weekend. Usually they'll invite an author, and if there are any local authors who happen to want to come, then they come and hang out and have a good time as well. But they'll usually invite one top line person who's of some note in the industry as kind of a guest of honor. And Confusion is of that sort. It's 48, 49 years old. Has been going since the early 70s. Was started out of the Ann Arbor, University of Michigan Science Fiction Club, basically. And so there's quite a few of these around the country. They're not the Comic-Con, although they'll have a costume competition. They'll have, but mostly it's panel discussions among writers.
Okay. It's much more of a writing based conference rather than pop culture.
The small conventions used to have more of the pop culture component, but I think a lot of the Comic-Cons have sucked all that energy up, and become that. Like when I first started going to conventions in the early 2000s, they used to have media guests of honor and media guests like a Comic-Con. So it was like a mini Comic-Con. It was like a 1,000 okay. person, 2,000 person Comic-Con, right? And that's changed. It's become, you know, it's over the last 25 years or so. But if you're a science fiction fan and you're a fan of the, you know, certain writers, it's a fun weekend to see some of the writers that you might read up in a panel in a small room in front of you.
Okay. All right. So Confusion in the Metro Detroit, you guys meet up and you're inseparable apparently ever since. So, okay. So, what were the, before we get into talking about your project, so what were some of your writing influences? I mean, you both were writers. And so were you avid? Tobias, you said you traveled, you bounced around a lot up until 18 or college. So I'm guessing you read a lot. And Dave, it sounds like you were reading a lot too, since you were kind of like writing on the sly.
I have always been an avid reader. And my influences are many and varied. The science fiction, the old timey science fiction canon, Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Robert Heinlein, you know, those have been big influences. I first came to Confusion to actually meet and see an author named Lois McMaster Bujold, who wrote kind of military sci-fi adventure in the late 90s and early aughts. And that's actually how I knew Charlie Finley, was through a fan organization of hers. I've read a ton of Dostoevsky. I've read, you know, Tom Clancy's a big favorite, the early ones at least. All over the board. I love Lee Child, the Jack Reacher books. You know, those are just gold, basically. They're kind of a master course in how to write stuff that you read really fast.
Dude, have you seen that new book by that person who basically shadowed Lee Child live as he wrote the last book?
No.
I ordered it. It's on the to-read pile, and I can't wait. It is the most neepery. I read an article based on it, and it's the most writing neepery I've ever come across. It's a book about watching another writer write a book over his shoulder, literally hilarious. Over his shoulder. Literally just sat there and watched him write and wrote about the experience.
Wow.
I'm not really sure how to take that. It sounds like it could go either way. Like it could be really fascinating, or like, oh my goodness, just kind of like, it took me an hour to get through this one page. Right. So Tobias, what about you? What are some of your writing influences?
Oh, good grief. I'm all over the place. You know, everything from, you know, the dialect of the Caribbean and the stories I was told growing up to the stories I heard on radio. There's this huge oral tradition culture in the Caribbean. So I was hearing stories from day one, whether it's family, friends. There's an art of telling stories where I grew up that is something else. And, you know, even just, you know, personalities on the radio who told stories. So the idea of storyteller was firmly in there in my brain as something that I admired and was attracted to. I learned to read extremely young because I was just obsessed with story and I wanted to be able to read the stories myself. So I learned to read before most people around me, and then started tackling really large books as soon as possible because I lived on a boat growing up. So we had no power, no TV. So it was books or nothing, man. William Gibson once described himself as one of the last writers who grew up in a pre-TV or no TV generation of writers. And I was kind of like, or those of us who grew up in the developing world, dude, like maybe, for the Americans, that's true. But for me, it wasn't growing up on this boat. So I read anything I get my hands on. In the Caribbean, we have these things in the harbors where I grew up called take one, leave one libraries. It'd just be a bookshelf in a corner of a marina or in a dive shop or somewhere like that, or even like a small grocery store. And it'd just have all these books on them. And it would just have a sign that says take one, leave one, right? So you'd bring one of yours, take one of the ones that looked interesting. Well, I confess, as a child, I may have taken more than I left to build up my own library, but I would just go in there and my whole guiding principle was I would open up a book and start to read it. And if it caught my attention, it went home with me. And if it didn't, I put it back on the shelf. And I would just haunt these places, just looking for any new stock. I mean, I would have just in the back of my brain all the titles that were at any given take one, leave one bookshelf that I knew of, location of, you know? And because of that, I read anything from like, I remember reading these like really cheap Westerns, the Calamity Jane series. I read Nora Roberts. I would read Arthur C. Clarke, the old, you know, old 50s SF that Dave was talking about. And then because it was just random, I encountered a lot of really old Golden Age SF. You know, I remember being at a science fiction workshop with all of these writers who were way above me in terms of prestige and career. And they were asked us to introduce ourselves by some of our favorite short stories. And I love this writer called Cordwainer Smith. Paul Leinebarger is his real name. Cordwainer Smith wrote these insanely wild, mythological-like stories back in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. And they still hold up because, unlike the time, he was so inspired by Chinese mythology. His godparent was one of the founders of the Chinese Republic. And so he had this sort of third culture childhood, and they really resonated with me as a third culture kid myself. So, you know, here I am like quoting from 1930s science fiction, A.E. Van Vogt and Cordwainer Smith and stuff like that. So I have this really wild breadth of stuff I've read. I'll get excited about the old 1930s diving bell adventure subgenre because I encountered them because someone got rid of them and put them in one of these take one, leave one shelves. And I just took them all home with me because I was like, I don't know what this is, but this looks fun. So yeah, every once in a while I'll write a short story and people will say like, oh, that was really novel and interesting and new. And I'll be like, well, it was a variation of an odd story I picked up in the from a 1941 analog, and I was just wanting to have a conversation with it. And I always think like, oh, everyone's going to point at this and be like, oh, you're just retreading old ideas. And it's just like, no, because no one's read a 1941 obscure analog short story that happened to be in a library, take one, leave one in the Caribbean that I came across in 1980, whatever.
Did it ever get to the point where you would like go to the, the little library and say, I've read all of these. There's nothing new. You have to wait
absolutely.
For something.
Absolutely. Because I'm ADHD and dyslexic, I taught myself to read extremely fast, uncommonly fast. And so at my height, I was reading 2 to 3 novels a day because I didn't have television or video games. I just, once my sister came along and my parents didn't have time for me, it was like books, man. I'm going all in on books.
All right. Well, what a great segue. So let's talk about books. Okay. So the two of you were working on these short stories for CIFWA. So did you, is that kind of like when the idea for the Runes of Engagement came about, or was it something like one of you, it's kind of like, hey, what if, and scenario. So what was the, I guess, the impetus for the idea for that one, or was there something else before that?
Dave, do you want to just run with the short story?
Yeah. So Toby will get frequently invited to do anthologies by an acquaintance of ours, John Joseph Adams, who does a lot of these anthologies. He's editor, and he was putting one together on the military and fantasy, right? It was just kind of a vague concept, and he was soliciting submissions from all of his favorite people. And Toby was like, hey, this has got you written all over it. Let's do this. I was like, okay, let's do this. And so we kind of kicked around the idea of a squad of Marines in Middle Earth, basically a squad of US Marines in Middle Earth. And we spent an altogether unholy amount of time just cracking each other up with concepts as to what kind of jokes we could make, what kind of silliness we could get away with. And the idea is the characters are what we call genre aware, right? They're the opposite of the characters in The Walking Dead who have never seen a zombie movie, right? They are fantasy nerds who also happen to be Marines and have been deployed to Middle Earth. And so they are just, I mean, it is just a wash in jokes and references and things like that. And we had an amazing time writing this short story. And we very, very quickly realized we had easily a novel's worth of material in it. And it took us a while. The full story is long of how we got to actually writing the novel. But we did. Basically was the we really could not get it out of our systems once the short story was out there, and we were just like, no, we just got to keep going with this because there's so much fun stuff there, and we felt really like it was really accessible. And the funny thing is for us was what we didn't realize was how much Dungeons and Dragons in particular would take off over the last 5 years as a cultural phenomenon. And we had already aligned the story with it. The way in which that dovetailed very nicely, but we really thought it was a really accessible concept. And we really wanted to just explore it further. So we set out to, And Toby's a working writer and writes a lot under contract. This was going to be a not under contract book. We were just going to write it just for giggles and see who was interested in it.
Okay, I do want to point out. So I was looking at some of the marketing materials for the book, and they pitch it. I think it's a brilliant way to describe it: Lord of the Rings meets Slaughterhouse Five by way of World of Warcraft. And I think that I think that sums it up perfectly because
they did such a great job.
Because it tells me exactly what to expect. I'm familiar with all three of those materials, and so I know like okay, it's going to be goblins and orcs and swords, but it's also going to be wit, and there's going to be dry humor, and there's also going to be sorcery and spells and all of the associated materials with it.
It's it's just one of those things where like we got together at one point, and after the story came out, and I remember saying something along the lines of like, Dave, I think we missed a few jokes for the short story. I could think of these five things that we could have done that would have been really hilarious. Yeah. And Dave went, five? I could think of nine just off the top of my head that have occurred to me since the story came out. And then we kind of like locked eyes and went, oh, like there's a lot more here that could be played with. And the funny thing was, each of the scenarios was, there's this thing about joy, right? And having kind of like an idea for something that is just sheer joy. And every time we were talking to each other, we would just say one of the scenarios that occurred to us, and the other person would laugh. Like, that's funny. That would have been funny, And it's like, okay, these have to happen. Right? They just have to happen. So at this point, nobody was knocking down our door asking us for a novel based on the short story, right?
Right.
It came out in the anthology. People don't tend to read short stories as much as they read novels. It's a game for people who love the form, right? You make a little bit of money on it, but it's, the fact that I've written 150 short stories has not put me in like a great retirement package, right? It's something I do because I love short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And with this short story, like it went out, it got a couple of reviews, but there were no phone calls going like, the world demands more of this. But Dave and Toby demanded more of it, because every time we ran into each other, we had a new joke and they landed. Like we were just cracking each other up. And I thought, as we started talking about it, we're like, if we're cracking each other up this much, there's got to be something here. So we set out to write it, and we put all of these jokes in. I mean, we rented a hotel room for 3 nights and basically hung out in, it was downtown Detroit, wasn't it? Because we went to that famous Greek place. Yeah.
Yep.
So we basically rented a place for 3 nights in downtown Detroit, ordered in and basically whiteboarded the heck out of this thing. How many of these funny scenarios can we cram into this outline and make it work? And I just remember it being a really joyous 3 days of just making each other laugh constantly, and trying to capture it. And that being the what we set out to accomplish. And I gotta say, like, I keep texting Dave this. We've been through this novel so many times, because not only did we write it, we revised it. We revised it with our agent. We sent it out. We revised it again. And it got rejected a lot, right? Because it's... Yeah. It's this odd thing. Do you have, are you a fan of these? Are you a fan of Dungeons and Dragons? Are you a fan of like MMORPGs? Are you a fan of Lord of the Rings? And are you a big enough fan of all of these that you're going to get all of these inside jokes, right? All the editors that we sent it to had really positive reactions, but marketing was like, what is this? It's funny. It's irreverent. It's weird. We didn't even have the word for like mass isekai back then, which is basically, the word for like a portal fantasy fan fiction, right?
Right.
All of that stuff wasn't there when we wrote it, because we wrote it, gosh, what, five
oh
years
my gosh.
Ago, 6 years ago? This thing's been making the rounds for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a weird object.
Yeah.
Because humor is hard. It's subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And it is humor. But it's also super accessible, we felt, and a lot of fun. And so it was really hard to see all these marketing places knock it down, because we thought, boy, if you just put this out there, anyone who's in any of these subgroups will get the jokes and have a lot of fun reading it.
They'll eat it up. Yeah.
They'll eat it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we had all of Dave's experiences as a Marine, all of these inside jokes by people who've served that Dave was putting in there, that like, some of them I didn't, I would have to swing back around and be like, Dave, can you explain this for me? I know there's something there. I know this is kind of funny, but I feel like you're laughing harder than I am. Can you explain this? And you'd be like, well, yeah, here's how this works, you know, and you'd be like, okay, thank you. And there's this, all this like marine humor that he was telling me that overlaps with geek humor that I was just finding really fascinating, you know, that he was putting in there. So like, I just felt that like, I felt like there was a lot of stuff that was just being missed by marketing that I went like, there are all these different ways in to this book for these different subgroups that would get a kick out of it.
Okay, that is one of the things I actually want to address, is because you brought up the word joy and just having such a great time writing it. And I think that's really key, because I mean, my area of, I'm not going to say expertise, but like my forte is more screenwriting, and that you can tell a writer really enjoys the material based on how it reads on the page, that they're writing it not just to entertain the reader and the audience, they're writing it to entertain themselves. And just like looking at your faces, which were very, you know, all smiles and happiness while you've been describing this, that it tells me like that is, it must be evident on the pages of this book that, you know, you can read this book and say like, these guys get it, but they also understand, like, they're writing it as fans for fans.
Yeah, yeah,
they're not writing it like, oh, hey, here's a good cash grab for me. I know, you know, the geeks are going to really eat this up. It's just kind of like, hey, this is a thing we thought would be funny and we want to share it with you.
The advanced reader copy came in the mail the other day, and I picked it up and I accidentally read 5 chapters.
Yeah.
Were there any like, hey, I forgot we wrote that, or oh, that's really funny.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Every time I read it, I catch a new thing, and I don't remember who did it at this point. I'm catching a thing and I laugh and I'm like, that was awfully clever. Was that a me or a Dave? I don't remember, but oh my gosh, that it cracked, you know, it cracks me up. And that I gotta say, honestly, I've never been that full of joy this far deep into the process. I'll be honest with you, usually by this point that a novel's coming out and I'm doing like the PR part, I'm like, what do you want from me? I birthed something. I made it happen. Like, I bled for you. Just read the damn thing. I'm over it. I don't want to see it again. I don't want to hear the title. You know, I put everything I had into this, and it's now out. Judge or move on. I don't know. But like, I'm a broken man now. I did a thing. But with this one, like, I just feel like I'm still laughing my ass off every time I crack open a part of it to look at it.
Ooh, that's great. What about you, Dave? You've been pretty, I mean, you've been laughing along, but I'm curious to take what's been your side of this.
This has been, This has been a long time coming, there's been so much joy involved with it. In fact, I remember there was a discussion we had even before we started writing the short story, where we were talking about like video games affecting writing. It may have even been a panel discussion at one of these conventions, and somebody asked, "How does video game affect your writing?" And I was like, "Well, I always try to put in pointless fetch and carry quests, like in MMORPGs, where somebody has to go and do something that seems absurdly pointless." And we invented a character. We had a character, Jillian Shane is the character's name, and she's a huge fan of these kinds of things. And the moment she realizes that she is embroiled in one of these pointless fetch and carry quests in the story, and she is just so pissed off that it's actually happening for real, that for me was like one of those moments, like, I got to write it, and it makes sense. The quest actually makes sense within the context of the story. And yet here she is realizing that she's in the middle of this just absurdity, and she hates it. But she's going to do it anyway, but she hates it. And that kind of thing, like, I mean, Toby's laughing right now. It just cracked me up. It cracked us up. And that's the fun of it. I mean, part of that is the fun of writing genre aware characters, which, if you want to go to screenwriting, you go back to Scream, right? The original Scream screenplay, right? And the how aware those characters were that they were in a horror movie. Right. And so that's been the you know, a big part of the fun. It is a lot of fun when you get to do that and you get to play with the conventions and the tropes and the same old set pieces, you know, not to spoil anything else, but we have, you know, we have characters that are straight out of fantasy movie central casting, you know, and kind of the fun is like, what are they actually doing here? What is their actual role? And, you know, are they just that, or are they something more? Do they point to something else that's happening in this world? And that too has just been so much fun to just to be able to play with that.
On the craft level, making it make sense, mm-hmm. creating that internal right. logic. So it's not only just right. that this person's on, you know, the fetch and carry quest, but that it's something that you're going to enjoy reading as a reader, and it's not going to feel like it's a grind, while also, right. you know, nodding along and going, God, I hate it. I hate that yeah. part of video gaming itself, you know, where you're sure. just grinding stuff out.
Yeah. Yeah, you had mentioned Scream, but my mind automatically went to Galaxy Quest. So yes. yeah, that kind of thing, the, you know,
it's
the
same kind of joy. Yeah. yeah. Well, we're not taking yeah. the piss. We're absolutely saying this is something that's dumb, but hey, we love it. Like, we're part right. of it, you know, like right. it's something.
And you're
that,
embracing that.
You know, we're embracing it. Yeah. At one point, one of the characters turns down a literal side quest.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, you kind of touched on it a little bit. So what was the outlining process? You had the scenario, you know, the Marines in a Middle Earth type world. Mm-hmm. Did you know how it was going to end, or did you like weigh a couple of options, or did you just kind of like, I can't do this. Like, were you just kind of like, did you pants it? Just kind of like, hey, let's just see where the characters take us. And it amazes me when people say that they can do that.
Well, a big part of it was we had the original short story, and the original short story is, I think, the first three, maybe four chapters of the book. And that was a very, very simple escort mission for video game parlance again. Where the Marines go and they are escorting a high value VIP back to base. And that's it. That's all they're doing. And they run into obstacles and they have to fight their way back to base. And then the outlining kind of grew out of that. It's like, okay, well, that has to be the genesis of the story. So what's the story? Where's the story going to take us in terms of who she is, the VIP, and what does she mean to this world and that kind of thing? And then how do these characters stay involved? Those are kind of the really, really basic questions that kind of drove the rest of the story. The actual process, Toby described it, was 3 days in a hotel room, whiteboarding out. And we use a writing software called Scrivener. And Scrivener really lends itself very well to outlining and structuring stuff. And it was back and forth, one of us at the keyboard and one of us standing and pacing or whiteboarding or whatever. And just hammering out, like, what were the story beats? What's the acts look like? What's the story beats, you know, how, and not getting mired in the middle, making sure the middle was nice and exciting and interesting. That was kind of it, but it if we had written a slightly different plot for the short story, we probably would have ended up with a completely different book in the end, because although again, probably the same in a lot of the ways, but yeah, just because that's kind of, we kind of felt almost locked in to kind of keep telling that story and explain what happens after that little short story ends.
Okay, so you spent the 3 days kind of, like, as you said, like hammering out the story beats and kind of like the general layout. So what was it after those 3 days? Did, like, you know, Toby say, okay, I'm going to go work on, you know, chapter one, and then he'd send that to you, and Dave works on chapter two and sends it back? Or was it just like a lot of back and forth?
Well, what we did was Dave took the first swing at the first half. I think from what I remember, you did like a rough first draft of the yep. first half, and then you yep. sent that to me, and then we had, I think we used Zoom then, or Skype or something. Zoom wasn't around then, so it would have been Skype, because this was like 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we Skyped and kind of worked, like, took what we had and did a second round of outlining to get to the end. And then I started taking the rough draft and just doing the second draft, right? And then once Dave finished up the second half, gave him the first half and started working on the draft of that.
Yeah.
And then it just was back and forth, back and forth, right? Always back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Because it's in the iteration that you start to, it's like sanding almost. You start with that heavy grit, you know, getting those big structural issues figured out and the beats. And once you have the structure, then you can start arrowing into like character logic, motivation, dialogue. What would they say? Things like that. I remember our agent got involved on structure at some point, and there was a lot of work that ended up going into the middle.
We restructured a big chunk of the middle. And if you'll remember, so I'll delve further. So one of my joys also in writing this is that it is mostly from the perspective of junior enlisted Marines, right? Which is not a perspective you get very often in fiction. Like usually it's officers or Navy SEALs who are always like senior enlisted. The guys have been in for 20 years, or the high speed officers that somehow know how to do literally everything, which is never true. And I really wanted to tell this story because that's what I was in the Marines. I was junior enlisted. I was a Lance Corporal. I was not super high speed. So telling a story from their perspective was really important to me. And we consciously told the short story that started this all from the perspective of the squad as a whole. So in the beginning, the squad as a whole is magically mentally linked. So they're all kind of in each other's thoughts. And that was really a cool concept. So then when we drafted it, we gave literally every character at least two viewpoint scenes. So there were at least two scenes. Now that magical thing wears off after the events of the short story. And as we move into the novel, they're all on their own. So we gave at least like two scenes to every person in the story, in the novel, and every one of the Marines. And our agent went, no. She was like, pick two, three at most. I'm like, all right.
Yeah, I was going to ask. So, like, as you were doing,
you're really smart.
As I was going to say, as you were doing the back and forth, what did a lot of things change? Were there like just some minor tweaks? Like, oh yeah, we originally had this idea, but what if we tried this approach instead? I mean, or were you pretty much set from the beginning?
That's a good question.
There were. Like we didn't really deviate from the big arc. Like in fact, even all of the places that we visit in the story and things like that pretty much stayed static throughout. I think a lot of what we did was really what Toby referred to as the sanding, where we really, took the jokes and made sure that they punched, that they hit the right heights, that everything was clear enough that we would, and that was the great thing for me. And it's continued actually all the way through the copy editing process as a Marine, that I know what I'm talking about when it comes to all of the military stuff, and Toby doesn't. And so every time he'd be like, what does that mean? Like, okay, I need to explain that, or I need to cut it. And then, and that's how we would proceed. And so there was just a lot of that kind of thing, punching the jokes up, making sure that everything was, hit the right heights.
Bracket notes that would be like, what would a Marine do in this situation? Just setting up something and then handing it off to Dave and being like, what would the reaction here be? Or what would the plan of attack be? Like, I particularly love that you were pulling out the manual for like overflight firing procedures for like when under attack by dragons. Stuff like that. Details like that just made being a co-author with you, just total yeah. money.
the ability, the that's another one where it was including that in a story, including that in something, right? That was the most absurd thing we trained, one of the most absurd things we trained on when I was in the School of Infantry in the Marines was as infantry Marines shooting at planes flying overhead trying to strafe you. And I was like, this is the most absurd thing I've ever done. And now, like, oh, dragons. Yes. Okay, great. We can, yes, I can include that now. And it was, yeah. And it's just like, yep, there we go.
Okay. So, it's
great because it all works within context, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's like, right. There's a bunch of very serious Marines being attacked by a dragon. What do we do?
It's exactly what they do. That's absolutely it. Yeah, that's what we do.
All right. Okay. So here's the really big question. I'm sure everybody mm-hmm. is concerned about: is there a gelatinous cube?
Saving that for book two.
Yeah, we can't put everything.
I got to say
in.
Though, like I'm really glad we didn't, because Dungeons and Dragons absolutely nailed the gelatinous cube in that movie.
Correct.
Yeah, just because it was in that Disney film Onward too. So because I was thinking, okay, you know, everyone who does fantasy, for some reason, there's just such a universal appeal of the gelatinous cube. So I had to ask.
It's such a delightfully absurd concept in gaming and in fantasy. It's like, yep, there's a beast that just fills dungeon corridors perfectly, so that it's so hard to see, and you stumble into it and get trapped, and mm-hmm. it's a creature. And it's just like, what an absurd concept. And yeah, it's so fun to play with. But yeah, book two.
Book two. Okay, I was going to ask. So what are the plans now? Okay, so this one is complete. Did you have so much material left over that you can do a sequel of some sort, or like another story set in this same kind of world?
I feel, David, I actually haven't sat down and discussed this much because we've been so focused on this book.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I feel there's a lot of potential in this world.
Yeah.
I think we've had some hints to each other that if this book does well, we'd love to keep, you know, I'd love to keep going. If it, you know, if fans like it, if readers like it, you know, if it touches, if it sparks, then yeah, if there's an interest in doing more, this is the most fun I've had writing a book. So I could do this process again and again and again. But I mean, I guess now it's up to the readers, right? Not mm-hmm. It's right. just put the pressure on them.
So speaking of which, when is the book scheduled to be released?
It's the June end of 16th? June.
June
or middle of June.
Middle of June. I think it's June 16th.
Middle of June.
June 18th.
Who's June dyslexic? 18th.
Okay. Night. Okay, well, you know what? I think all answers can probably be found if you go to tachyonpublications.com, since they are the publisher of this book. And it is called The Ruins of Engagement. And I love the tagline, all initiative, no dice. So was that one of you guys or was that the marketing department?
No, that was Tachyon. What's been great about working with Tachyon is that they've completely understood the remit here. They understand the book. They get, you know, what is fun about it, and they've been having a lot of fun with it. So down mm-hmm. to the, you know, right off the bat, getting the cover right, it's a big honking dragon, you know, and a handful of small Marines in the bottom of the cover, you know, going, oh crap, yep. What do we do now? That's the book right there. All yep. initiative, no dice. I could not have come up with a better subtitle myself.
Yeah.
I saw that and loved it.
Yeah, I got it as soon as I read it, too. It just told me everything I needed to know. Okay, gentlemen, are either of you on social media that you are more than welcome to promote?
I'm on Blue Sky, Tobias Bakel, and I'm not on social media too frequently these days, but I do have a Blue Sky account. And, of course, TobiasBakel.com is my website, which is currently under construction, so don't go unless this is like, you know, let's say late May.
Okay.
I have a website, dave.kletcha.net. You can go there, Dave Kletcha on Blue Sky, Dave, DAVE. and David Kletcha on Instagram, because I like to keep things super consistent at all times. You can find me and find the random pictures I post on Instagram.
Okay. Well, fantastic, guys. This has been Tobias Bakel and David Kletcha. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here today. This was so much fun talking about yourselves and your book and your material and the whole writing process. It was just really enjoyable, and I hope you had a good time.
That was fun.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. And the book, again, The Runes of Engagement, R-U-N-E-S, Runes of Engagement from Tachyon Publications. It comes out, in theory, mid-June, so you can go to tachyonpublications.com for all of the details. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. That's Tobias. That is Dave. I am Paul. You can check out my screenwriting blog, Maximum Z, at MaximumZ.blog. I'm also still on Twitter, because I'm not calling it that other thing, at Maximum_Z, and I'm also on Instagram at Pez Screenwriting. And please check out and follow this podcast Twitter account at Podcast CWL, of course, for Creative Writing Life. Again, it's Creative Writing Life podcast. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and most importantly, go write something.